Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, Heritage Radio Network podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org. Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Chiara De Lis Pepe. That's her full name. That's the last time I'm going to call her that. We're going to talk to Chiara about Emidio Pepe, Abruzzo, wine, her wines, and a lot more. We're going to taste, and this knocked me off my chair, a 2000 Montepulciano de Abruzzo that Chiara brought in. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Chiara Pepe is a third-generation winemaker in Abruzzo, Italy. Her grandfather's grandfather made home wine in the basement dating back to the late 1800s, eventually becoming the Emidio Pepe Winery in 1964. One of the most highly regarded and sought-after wines in the world. Chiara, along with her mom and sister, run the winery, with Chiara overseeing the land, vines, grapes, and cellar. She farms biodynamically with no intervention in the cellar and is a magician with Trebbiano and Montepulciano di Abruzzo. Chiara is in New York to pour at the Caractère Salon, and she's been doing a few other events, which we'll talk about. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Chiara.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
I'm excited to sit across from you. I've been very much aware of your wines, drinking them and buying them whenever I can. And I'm excited to be face to face with you to talk about everything. We're talking in New York. Chiara is in town to pour wines at the Caractère Salon, and she participated in a panel on agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
What else have you been doing in New York?
Eating and drinking.
Okay. It's a good spot to do that. Kind of better.
Catching up with friends.
Okay. But is it fair to say you really came in to be part of Caractère?
Indeed, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
When are you going back?
On Monday.
Okay, and so it's a short Friday, so she has the weekend to party. All right, before we get into the wines, the winery, everything you do out there, I want to talk to you about three things, all right? I want to talk to you about your personal journey, sort of when the wine thing started and how you got here. I want you to tell me a little about the family winery, more of a chronological history. And then I think in a little bit, when we start talking about the wines and the vineyards, frame, you know, where Abruzzo is and what's going on there. So let's start with, tell me your journey in life and wine that got you really to where you are today, which is a family winery running side by side, the best thing with your mom and your sister. When did the wine thing start for you?
Yeah. So it's interesting because everything happened in a very natural and organic way in some sort.
Makes sense.
You know, like we live on top of the winery, so there's never a distinction in within wine life, family life, and like everything, it's intermingled.
So you grew up
I grew up at the winery. Yeah.
Like born and grew up, little kid running around. Yes, okay. Yeah, sorry to interrupt. So,
and you know, like the estate, when I was growing up, it was it's very small. It was just grandma and granddad running the whole thing. And they had four actors. And so I was basically, you know, my mom would drop me at grandparents that I would hang out with them, whatever they were doing, whether grandfather was pruning or whether they were both bottling, and I was just, you know, sitting around with them. And so I kind of like got a very natural feeling of what wine life was, that never felt that felt natural to them and normal to them. And I kind of got that sense of being part of that thing. And so, you know, slowly I grew up, and I started traveling with grandfather a little bit while he was traveling around.
How old were you?
Very early, 14, 15.
So a young teenager.
Very young.
He had the presence of mind to say, "You're coming with me, let's go."
He would always be, you know, he was very smart because he never let us feel the pressure of like working into the winery or taking over, but he was very good at passing on the passion. So that, you know, let us very free
smart
to, you know, travel, do our things, study something else. I didn't study enology. I studied, you know, business. That's completely different.
Where would he take you traveling?
We went to Australia. Grandfather loved Australia.
Oh, so some pretty cool, funky, far places. Not like Trentino,
no,
Alto, anything.
No, no, no.
Like
we, you know, plane and, yeah, you know, on the other side of the oceans. We came to New York since, you know, yeah. And basically what attracted me back was passion and not sense of responsibility, for instance. So he was very smart in doing that.
His plan worked. So what happens? I mean, how do you pursue that?
Little by little, I started, you know, traveling by myself and spreading the gospel and talking about the wines. And till the point, and I completed my studies and I kept doing that, till the point in which talking about wine wasn't enough anymore for me. I wanted to make wine. And so happened, like this series of thing that happens in life. I was at a tasting in which I was sitting next to Aubert de Vilaine on one side, and I asked him a question, and I asked him, if you go back, what would you study? And he wrote me on a little paper a course in Burgundy at the university. Basically, you were planned to go to school just one day per week, and the rest of the week you had to be in the vineyards. And I've enrolled right away, clearly, as well.
On his recommendation.
Yes.
How old were you then?
I was 26.
Okay.
So later on, I had completed my studies in economics, and then I kept, you know, working for the estate, and then I
did. You ever have other outside jobs? You know,
no, I've always
worked
always
for
the estate.
So you're always tied to the family.
Yes.
Okay.
And then I enrolled. I moved to Burgundy, and I started working and studying enology and viticulture. And I spent 1 year there, and I think it was the most enlightening period that I've had so far in terms of accumulating a lot of knowledge in a very fast way and a lot of information. Because, you know, Burgundy is a community where people
right
are very excited and happy to share thoughts and share little details and share winemaking ideas. And
it's a community.
It's a very good place where to learn and think about wine, and everybody wants to share and drink all the time. So you have opportunity to taste a lot of wines and to walk the vines of Le Lubis Le Roi and see what they're thinking and see what they're doing. And so you have a lot of inspiration altogether, combined with everything I grew up with. So the knowledge that I gained just by watching and observing and living in a winemaking family. So I came back, and that's when I took over viticulture and winemaking.
Was the program a year or was
year
less, and you stayed around? So you did the full
one
program,
year, yeah.
And it was fairly intensive?
It was intensive because of the context.
Right.
It was
which you described a little.
Yeah. And so I came back, and I was very excited. And that's when I did my first harvest at Pepe in 2020.
Oh, 2020?
Yeah.
That's only...
just 4 years ago.
I didn't realize it was...
Yeah.
Okay, so when you say you came and did your first harvest, everyone was happy that you came back. They embraced the idea that you were ready to come.
I was very much expected.
So who gave you the directive, now go out and do the harvest, and here's what you're going to do after that? How did that play out?
Well, it was my aunt, especially, because she was in charge of winemaking before me. And there was a point in which...
That's Sophia?
Yeah, correct, correct.
And that's your mom's sister? Or
indeed.
Okay.
Yeah. So my mom and my aunt are the owner of the estate today. Right. But she was vinifying before me, and she took over from grandfather. But there was a point in which I was traveling a lot, and they were like, you better come home. There's a lot of work down here. And so I was expected, and I was, you know, I had the call back in Abruzzo. And so I did. But
were
you
emotionally ready?
I was ready after Burgundy. I wouldn't have been ready before Burgundy, for sure. I needed so much more security under the point of view of the technical aspects, the chemistry aspects, the more technical part, which I've only been observing, but I felt I needed to learn more and be secure and be strong. And that's exactly what Burgundy offered me. And yeah.
So we're talking about a harvest 3 years later. I mean, 2023, you're probably at the end of the harvest or near it. So today and going forward, what are you tasked with doing? What are your responsibilities?
Okay. Well, it has been a big change because, like, if before I was, you know, moving around from New York to Tokyo and then spending, like, the important and crucial moment at the estate, now I'd say I'm for 80% of my time at the estate. And had the luck and opportunity to build myself a younger team that works with me in the vineyard and in the cellar. And I'm in charge of all the viticulture aspects and vinification aspects. So I'm spending a lot of time in the vineyards, especially. I think that's the part where I put more of my energies, because everything has been changing a lot over the past decade
in the
or
world.
So.
I mean, we'll talk about that, you know, the challenges. You know, you said you brought in people, you know, some younger people.
Yeah.
Does that mean the people that were there were kind of old thinkers and you need to clear it out, or there weren't that many people and you needed to add, or a little of both?
A little bit of both.
I mean, you know, this is a family business. Yeah. It's kind of controversial for you to come in. And
yeah.
How'd that go?
Yeah. It is always a tricky and delicate moment, because I've inherited grandfather's team who were a bunch of 80 years old.
Oh, it's time anyway. No age discrimination, but it's time.
No.
Plus, you need to fulfill your vision and push it.
As well. And it was very hard to motivate them to give a silica at 5 a.m. in the morning. And they were thought they were spraying water somehow in the air. And they were like, why are we even doing this? So, you know, as you can imagine, I needed somebody that was, you know, pushing and enforcing my own vision of farming and agriculture that I'm dreaming for Pepe. So now it's great, because I have a team of six, and it's a team that it's the same team that move around vineyard and cellar. So I have no division in between the two, so that everybody's aware of what's happening all the time in the vineyard and in the cellar. And when we receive the fruit from a very specific vineyard, everybody exactly recalls how the season was and how that vineyard behaved
very in tune
throughout the whole the season. So
is that one of the aspects of what these people are doing versus the older guys? I mean, how much different?
Yeah.
I mean, when you farm the way you do and you have that overall vision, you execute it. But the things you're doing now, how much different then?
I think what I'm planning, it's a totally different tightness of symbiosis in between human and plants.
Or have
and,
symbiosis at all.
Yeah.
Right.
And so the conversation that is open with my team goes to a different level of intimacy, that nowadays we have so many more information on how the plant function and how certain rhythms actually influence a plant's behavior. And now we don't only know by observation, we know also based on scientific facts. So we're able to incorporate the two things and have a much broader and more detailed vision of what's going on. And I think that is really the base also to face what's happening in terms of climate and balance. So I think, I know it is a
more modern approach, taking advantage of what's available and being more keyed into it, right?
Indeed, more fine-tuned, but also farming with more delicacy and more precision of observation without, you know, I'm moving in different direction, and I think I'm learning a lot because I'm, you know, giving certain impulses and see how nature responds back to me. And so we are very much in a phase of fast learning because, you know, we are experiencing very different seasons in very short, you know, time frame. And so we're watching and we are experimenting with mink treatments. We are like slowly but surely going almost completely no-tilling without being extremely dogmatic around it. And so like all those things require certain things to be in place in order to build up to what you want to achieve.
Is anyone, whether it's your aunt, mom, or anyone else, is anyone standing over your shoulder, you know, saying, don't do that or try this? Or you're basically out there with your crew, like you said, you know, figuring out what you think is best. How does that work?
There are two things that I always think is that I've been given a lot of freedom by my family. They've been incredibly open-minded. And grandfather was the very first one who pioneered something completely weird in Abruzzo back in the days. Nobody was aging wine in Abruzzo. Nobody was still planting in pergola. Everybody was transitioning to like modern ways of planting.
So before you get more descriptive, because I want to spend more time on that, that's a good segue. Just give me a quick line of the history.
Yeah.
You know, because you say grandfather, like, yeah, where did he fit in? And your mom, yeah, you know, just go.
Yeah,
don't,
yeah,
spend too much time on each
I'll be
thing.
Fast. So grandfather's grandfather was making wine in the family home where grandfather was born.
Literally a home winemaker, yes, for the table, right?
Indeed, yeah, yeah. Table consumed at the house. Grandfather was born in that house. He saw winemaking being, you know, done at the house since he was a little kid. The family was a family of farmers, so he knew how to farm land. At the age of 30 years old, he realizes that he wanted to do something of his own, and he wants to create something. What did he know how to do best? Winemaking. Because he saw in the family and he knew how to do it somehow.
He was a smart guy.
And it was like, that's what I'm going to do. So 1964, he bottled for the first time his own vintage. So he had one parcel.
So in 64, he said, this is the beginning of not an internal family,
yeah,
wine.
I'm
going to
bottle, I'm going to sell it. I'm going to sell the family wine.
Did he sell that wine? Or he held
half,
on to it?
Half. He did half. Half he held on to it, and then the other half he sold. But there were about 4,000 bottles being produced back then. And grandfather that same year gets married to my grandmother. And together they embark in this journey. Grandmother was a teacher. She leaves her job very early to be next to grandfather because they were literally the two of them. For probably the first 20 years, it was a very small estate in within that were making in between 4,000 and 8,000 bottles per year. So
when you say that, you're talking like 1964 to 84,
indeed,
like those years,
yeah, those
were
years,
just very kind of low output, quiet.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So it was very artisanal. They were still vinifying at the bottom of the very old house. you start, grandfather starts selling a little bit, but at the very first beginning already, he starts holding back onto some of the production because he had this gut feeling that Montepulciano needed to age. So,
is this a guy who either he was, you know, in his own world, didn't travel as much or whatever? Did he taste Barolos and Tuscan wines? And other, did, like, how did he know that, you know, the Montepulciano needed it? He just tasted it and realized the structure, right?
I say it's a gut feeling. It's my imagination because you wouldn't say much around it. So grandfather always, as soon as he started making wine, like he was a very good farmer and rooted in his place, but he also traveled the world because he loved it and also because his wines were much more appreciated abroad than in his own, you know, land. But that is normal somehow. But yet, it was a gut feeling. It was an intuition. It was a necessity. He always thought that Montepulciano was too much all at once when young, and he only thought that delicacy and grace and elegance could arrive with time. So,
all right, so let's finish the timeline.
Yeah,
so we're up to like the 80s. It's kind of a good, interesting, quiet start.
Yeah.
Then what happened?
Happens that grandma and granddad had three daughters. Clearly, granddad, when the third daughter is born, he faints at the hospital because he was looking for a boy that could drive the tractor, right? Meanwhile, grandfather, as soon as he started to have a little bit of money, he starts the building of a cellar, but that is not a production cellar. It is an aging cellar. And that shows the big vision he had around aging.
That was like his first commitment.
Uh-huh.
You know, backing up his idea of aging, he needed.
Yeah. And also that goes with a financial possibility of, because it's complicated when you start aging in terms of cash flow. Because
there is no cash flow.
So it is complicated.
Now, the money he has to finance is from the growth in production and sales.
He was selling a little bit and whatever
he was
selling.
Putting all the money back into
the cellar. Okay. Yeah. And three daughters, only two follow up and they inherit the winery. And now we're talking early 2000s.
Your mom and Sophia, aunt?
Indeed. So
when did they get the nod, like, you're running the winery? When was that?
Early 2000s.
Okay.
Yeah, early 2000s. The estate was quite small till back then. And there, my aunt was young, and then my mom was called back. My mom was an accountant, and she was like, okay, you two come back, and now you're part of this. So they inherit the winery. My mom takes over all the finance and
business
administration of the thing, and my aunt does all the practical stuff. So my aunt, before that, followed grandfather just watching him in the cellar. Grandfather was a very complicated person to take over from because he was very jealous of his own thing. He was very, very particular and meticulous and precise.
Even his own kid he wouldn't open up to?
He would be very jealous, and it took forever for my aunt to take over.
So she learned by osmosis, just by being and watching.
Yes, watching. So from the, you know, early 90s till 2000 when she took over, she watched. And 2000 was her first vintage.
We have that bottle in
indeed,
front of us.
Yeah, here we
we'll
are.
We'll talk about that
yes.
in a little bit.
And both of them have been running the winery since, and grandfather been observing and being very, you know, watching on us. And so, yeah, and now in 2020, me and my sister came into the winery and being like, you know, part of things. So now, in fact, there are three generations working together.
When your grandfather passed, right?
No, he's still. Still
wow,
watching
how old
on
is
us.
He?
91.
And
91.
Is he both a healthy 91 or
healthy 91. Healthy 91, I have to say. He's still
awesome.
Walking up the vineyards. He's still like, you know, not active anymore. Like, so he's like, he would ask questions, but.
So he doesn't bug you?
No, not any longer.
He doesn't roam around as much.
But has been, yeah, has been a long time of that.
All right. So that.
So that is the experience.
That brings us up to it. Now we can talk about all the cool, fun, interesting stuff. So. A nod to your grandfather. I mean, he certainly was ahead of his time, you know, in all the research and, you know, talking to people. One of the things we're going to get into that you talked about a little is he did not interfere with the natural rhythms of the vineyards and even the vinification.
Yeah.
Is it fair to say, and I think the answer is yes, that you practice the same styles out in the vineyards and, you know, in your winemaking, right?
Absolutely.
So let's start outside in the vineyards, okay? You're farming organically and biodynamically. So the question is not what is biodynamics. The question is what are the elements or how do you farm biodynamically? There's the whole Rudolf Steiner thing.
Yeah.
Wasn't your grandfather farming organically and somewhat biodynamically before there were even? So tell me, you know, that carries over what you do. You talked about your own crew and changes. What does that mean to people? Because that's really a cornerstone of what Pepe is that, you know, it's thoughtful, sustainable farming.
I would say grandfather would farm his vineyard like gardens. He would always... Like, I remember being a little girl and seeing him spend just a lot of time walking the vines, just walking the vines and, you know, putting the leaves up. But he would be, like, there, immersed a lot of time. And I think partially quality of observation comes through that.
I agree.
Through being immersed in nature, in within your own vineyards. And he would always radically refuse any use of chemicals, both in the vineyards and in the cellar. So those were the very first base ground of Emilio Pepe, spontaneous fermentation, and wines that I've never seen any
weed. Explain what spontaneous fermentation is. That's just using the natural yeast on the skins that exist.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Where some people were bringing in and adding yeast.
To me, notion of terroir includes and has to include the use of natural yeast because that changes every year. So if you respect seasonality and you want to make wine that have a sense of place, well... Those yeast are indigenous to your own place and nobody else's.
Was the observation looking around that most people, you know, maybe after the war started farming with chemicals or a lot of people had a similar sensibility?
It is complicated to say. I think it's very much of individual act of sensitivity and respect towards land. It is very true that in within the, you know, late 60s and early 70s, industrialization arrived in the farming world. And clearly all of a sudden you had those huge tractors and you have wheat killers
machinery.
And
has an impact on the land.
Yeah.
Chemicals?
Yeah, all of a sudden in the 70s.
But tell everyone why people use chemicals. The output? I mean, the
cutting
end result
corners.
Was terrible, but...
I think it's poor knowledge of the results and cutting corners.
Right.
I think there cannot be any cutting corners in farming because... You will leave a mark written into your land. And unfortunately, and today we know what is the impact onto our health and to the microbiome of the soils when those chemicals arrive. There's no going back.
there's no microbiome.
There's no microbiome. Yeah. So I feel incredibly lucky that grandfather always strongly refused any of that, because I've inherited soils that were pristine and soils under which, you know, and also when you inherit something like that, the responsibility that you inherit, it's even stronger, because you're like, oh, like I got it to be improving even more, something right. that is already incredible, you know. So, but it's definitely more responsibility that comes, because there's no restoration to be done. There's no building back life. Life is already there. How do you elevate a system and an ecosystem that is already in place?
So some people inherit property where it was treated, and you can, to some extent, bring it back, right? Mm. Not really.
It's very complicated. It's complicated. Or it takes so long.
Right. You never had that challenge. Yes. But you feel the responsibility as a steward to keep it, you know, and make it better. So what are some of the things you're doing? I mean, you're like hand picking. You mentioned machines.
Of course. No machinery.
You know.
There's a lot of things that I'm experimenting. And as I said, especially in the farming area, because what do you do when you inherit a winery that has been running for 60 years and people know Emilio Pepe through a sense of artisanality and sense of place and wines that can age for a very long time? So you have a certain legacy related to that in a climate that is radically changing. So to me and my interpretation of vision is, first, I have to keep the project alive.
So you said, and I thought this was very interesting, and this is where you're going. You said you are a daughter of global warming.
Yeah.
And you are. Because what you inherited physically is now subjected to this challenge, right? So what are those challenges, and what do you have to do?
Yeah. So,
I mean, being biodynamic organic
that
helps,
is an incredible tool.
But let's talk about
that is an incredible tool.
Different what you have to do today than 2000.
And to me, is that you know, as while keeping grandfather's project alive, I still want to be delivering the same idea of wines that he was making, but as a lot of inputs climatically are changing, I still want to go from the same point A, so my terroir, my farm, to the same point B, wines that have sense of place and that can age for a very long time and they are reflecting the season they're growing into. But to go from point A to point B, I have to take a very different route from what grandfather was taking.
Let's talk about that.
So first, and while I'm not changing any strong aspect in within the vinification, in the farming, that's where I'm changing most of the things. So I'm rethinking shading and vineyard soil managing. So grandfather back in the days used to plow a lot. It was his own way of taking care of his own vineyard. Now we are, as I said before, without being fully dogmatic, but slowly going completely no-tilling.
When he plowed, does that mean there wasn't that much cover crop?
Yeah.
Because you would break it up?
Yeah, yeah.
And so you're going in a different
now
direction.
Now the idea is to plant a lot of different essences, a lot of different greens, which through their root system, they interact with the soil and they build different kind of structure and compounds. And then I'm folding all those herbs and essences in order to create a natural mulching and a permanent cover crop. So this is allowing me to retain a lot of moisture into the ground, but also allowing me an auto-reseeding for the next growth of those permanent cover crop. And that has been functioning very well in very dry season, but as well in very rainy season, when that cover crop or that mulching that had, like, nothing had been cut and all the roots in place, helped to keep the soil in place and not being washed out, as I had, like, all my neighbors that had their vineyard washed out, their topsoils down into the bottom of their valley. And another aspect I've been working on is different kind of treatment. I've been experimenting treated with milk.
How do you come up with, let me see if milk is something versus honey and seawater? Yes, I mean, how do you come up with something?
Well, there have been several studies of the effect of the proteins of milk being activated by sunlight and becoming antifungic against especially Oidium. And when I was working in Burgundy, the vineyard I was working for, they were treating exclusively with milk. And as I was there in the vineyard, I could see how it was functioning and the reaction and the percentages accordingly to the pressure that they had in that season. So that gave me a lot of knowledge around the use and adjustment to the percentages of milk that you use accordingly to the pressure. Another thing that I'm working a lot is that I've been working on agroforestry in order to create an extra level of shading for my grapes. And grandfather was already working with pergolas, so a canopy protection, and the grapes were growing.
So that, talk about that for a second, is that vertical farming?
Vertical farming.
When people imagine vineyards, they see these low sideway things. Yeah. You're literally going the other way. It's a taller plant with a little different canopy.
It is very curious because...
And that goes back to your grandfather, right?
Yeah.
So what was the reason he did it and the benefit? And does that help with global warming?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
It all started, when you see people coming and seeing you as a winemaker, one of the first questions I would ask, it's, what's your surface, right? And I was thinking about that. And
you mean
I was
composition and everything?
Yeah. Like, how many hectares? What's your surface?
Right.
17, 20, 40. And I was like, well, no. We haven't got surfaces. We have volumes. We work with volumes. We work with everything that is visible, but everything that is underground and invisible. That is also the part that we take care of. And I was like, how can I occupy more of that volume? Because there is this tendency of the vine to... reached towards the light. And grandfather was already working on the pergola. He loved the pergola. He thought that Montepulciano could perform the best through a pergola because the grapes were only getting ripe in the shade and the skins was remaining very thin and the quality of tannins very elegant. Whether if you would grow Montepulciano in rows, it would be much more exposed to sunlight. The skin will get thicker and the tannins rougher. So you would lose that sense of elegance of tannins that could only achieve with pergola. And also what is very important is that you can have with pergola long ripening cycles, so having more of that phenolic ripening that we're trying to achieve because we want to make age-worthy wine by also preserving a lot of acidity, especially tartaric acidity. So it is crucially important in a situation of excessive sunlight to have pergola. So everything that I'm planting again, it's in pergola, but all those pergolas are surrounded by trees. So that we'll
you're trying to.
Yeah.
So that's literally planting trees around the vineyards that didn't exist?
Yeah.
But that's a long time project commitment.
Yes, indeed.
Never too late to start.
I mean, I'm starting now, so I can't blame for other people not doing it. Oh, that's my time now. That's when I'll start doing it.
It's amazing how on top of it your grandfather was, but it's amazing that there are still many opportunities to do the right things or add things that, you almost want to say, why didn't he do that? Well, he was caught up with doing other things the right way.
Yeah, and I think within the genetics, there is that gene or the necessity and the ambition of keep pioneering. Grandfather did something that people called him crazy back in the days. And now, people call me crazy because all my vineyards are a bit messy and there's a lot of
grass. Plenty of people look up to you too for what you're doing. Kiara, we have to take a quick break. But when we come back, I want to finish up out in the field. I want to talk about, the actual grapes. We talked a little about Montepulciano d'Abruzzo. Trebbiano. You grow a couple other grapes. Those are indigenous grapes. I want to get a little more info from you on that. And you're working with different sites. You mentioned earlier you started with 3-4 hectares. You have more than that now. So I want to know what that is. So we're talking to Chiara Pepe from Emilio Pepe in the Abruzzo region, or Abruzzo in Italy. When we come back, we're going to talk about the grapes and the sites, and then we're going to get into the cellar and talk about, you know, what the hell you're doing there. And I want to talk to you about aging. There's still plenty of stuff to talk about. So you're listening to The Grape Nation. We'll be right back.
Hi, listeners. We wanted to let you know that Heritage Radio Network's Julia Child Fellowship application is now open. The fellowship offers an enriching experience for aspiring food writers and journalists who share our passion for food systems change. The fellowship is a great way to progress in the field of food journalism and digital media and will start in early January 2024. This fellowship will provide participants with hands-on experience, mentorship, and access to an extensive network of industry professionals. The application deadline is November 27, 2023. Check out heritageradionetwork.org and click on the Julia Child Foundation Writing Fellowship link to learn more. If you or someone you know has interest in food studies and journalism, this might be a great fit. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and check out the application today. Thank you.
All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, Chiara Pepe, from Emilio Pepe, a legendary winery in Abruzzo for a lot of reasons. And a lot of the reasons is what we've been talking about, you know, the things they do to make these wines. It's steeped in tradition and history and all the right stuff. All right, so finishing up outside in the field, in the vineyards, you predominantly grow Montepulciano, the Abruzzo, and Trebbiano.
Yes.
You do Pecorino, which is interesting. And a little Caruso.
Uh-huh.
All right. So talk to me about those two grapes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're indigenous to the area, right?
Yeah, indeed. So grandfather planted those and inherited some of Montepulciano grapes. Vine back in the days, and then he planted more. He always replanted through master selection. So when we talk about Trebbiano d'Abruzzo, is the Trebbiano Abruzzese clone. Trebbiano is one of the most extended and planted families in Italy. And you have Trebbiano Spoletino in Umbria, Trebbiano Toscano in Tuscany, and Trebbiano Abruzzese, which clearly grandfather would say is the best of all. but it's a great varietal that comes in a loose bunch, and the berries are fairly small with a very transparent, almost translucent skin,
really?
Very, very thin, and normally has beautiful high acidity. Montepulciano, it's also a great varietal that we tend to protect from sunlight because we want that ripening would only happen through photosynthesis, and then, you know, the sugars will go through the grapes through sap and never direct contact, because it can get fairly rough if exposed to sunlight. And we love to pick both to those two grape varietals when they're ripe, because we think that the message of terroir, sense of place, happens when the grapes are phenolically ripened. And so, you know, through that idea, we try to make sure we extend the ripening cycle without alcohol getting too high. And we've always been vinifying them in the same exit way that grandfather told of at the very first beginning. So Trebbiano d'Abruzzo grapes, together as the Pecorino, are crushed by feet. And we do spontaneous fermentation in concrete. The concrete tanks are lined with glass to make the container perfectly neutral.
So you jumped right into that. You put things in concrete containers, which is a big thing about Pepe.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize the concrete is lined with glass. So there's not that direct exposure to the concrete
at
and
all.
The oxygenation you
no
get from
porosity whatsoever. The idea for grandfather was always to preserve well, first, not to have the contender influence the wine.
Right.
That's why I never used
a neutral.
Yeah, neutral. Grandfather always say the glass is the house for the wine. And that's why he made wine in glass-lined concrete tanks, and then he aged them in bottle. There's always glass all the way through our wine life.
So that's not unusual. You use mm-hmm. whatever vessel you want, oak, concrete without glass, glass. But he ages in the bottle. Plenty of people age in the bottle. In a few minutes, we're going to talk about that. It's not sitting there for a year, you know, which is an important aspect, excuse me, of what Pepe is. So finish up. So
yeah, and Montepulciano is hand destemmed. So we destem by hand, and the idea to destem by hand is because we want to keep a perfect integrity of whole berries.
So the machinery or other processes would compromise the berry.
Well, now you can probably buy the most expensive machines
that
and I could
will
do it
be
for
a
you.
Little less.
But for our production,
you're stuck in your old ways.
And for like, and a lot of people are asking me that exact question, like. Well, you're 30 years old, and you know that you can have access to all the machinery possible. And I'm like, for the amount of grape that I make, I love that, like, six people for 7 days only that would destem
the
grapes.
Destemming with six people is a seven-day process?
Yeah, by hand. But we touch each bunch.
It's
like, how incredible is that? And I love to do it myself. I will never exchange me doing that for 6 days in a row with a machine. Like, it is, I can't do that. And I love doing it personally. So I was like, oh, I don't know if it's a nostalgic thing or it's like, but I love to touch the grapes. I'm waiting for that.
It's your literal connection. You don't do whole cluster or anything.
No, because, well, I'm doing some experiments here and there just to have fun because that's what we need to do. Why not? But on a general base, and I think Montepulciano can do that in very specific year, but normally the full phenolic ripening of the berries arrives much earlier compared to the phenolic ripening of the stems. So if you would include the stems, you would have a lot of green and pyrazine that they're not necessarily, you know, needed. I also think that with the hand destemming, we achieve an incredible quality of whole berry situation in which the day after of the incubage of the berries, I have no juice for a pump over.
Wow.
It means that the whole tank, and we work with small tanks, and we unload all the berries by gravity, so the berries are never pumped. They never go through a pump.
It's the weight of their own gravity.
Yeah, but at the very first beginning, there's so much integrity that there's no juice being liberated. It means that I'm achieving a very good quality of intracellular fermentation, and only later on I would do. I'm quite delicate with extraction, and I think with the climate that is changing, that is definitely one of the things that has slightly changed. We're not extracting as we were back in the days, and I think, you know, it's quite of like a normal adjustment of you know, as being a daughter of global warming. And so that is kind of like a process of delicacy that it's happening. But, you know.
So when you say intracellular fermentation.
Yeah.
There's a little intracellular fermentation, then maybe the berry breaks, and then there's
a yeast continued outside. Yeah, indeed.
So the intracellular really is no yeast.
No yeast, it's enzymes.
It's enzyme. Okay.
Enzymes. So you have enzymatic and a yeast. So enzymatic, intracellular, and outside of the berry you have yeast. So that amplifies the spectrum of the aromatics that you're going to have because you have two fermentations happening exactly at the same time. So that, you know, that it's exciting to see happen. And once we were doing the decuvage, which is like, I don't realize, but it's only 2 weeks ago that I was doing the process of my Montepulciano 2023.
Are you done?
I'm done, yeah, okay. Completely done, yeah. Last racking before I left for
I
New York, and I was like, oh, so happy.
Yeah. So you talked earlier about, you know, the family starting with 4 hectares. If I'm correct, you're somewhere around 17.
Indeed, correct.
So is that obviously acquisition. Is that stuff right around Casa Pepe, or you found something good 2 miles away? Tell me how those secting, where are they situated?
So
you own them all?
Yeah, we own them all, and we farm them all. We never buy any grapes. We never sell any grapes. Grandfather had his own vineyards, and then, so four hectares at first, and then my mom and my aunt, when they started, they planned some more hectares in within 2007 and 2005, in within those 2 years. And then we haven't planted since, well, last year. So we planted in three different moments: grandfather, my mom and my aunt, and me. And so now we have 17 in production, and I've just planted 2.3 in three different locations.
So was that family property that wasn't planted?
No, we bought new land that grandfather loved, or my mom and my aunt loved, and we never bought any vineyard that was already planted because we wanted to have control over the genetic material
so
that was
So you had planted. Your eyes on plots, and if they became available.
Yeah. We acquired. And now we're done, but we're planning to expand the land that we own in order to plan crop rotation around our vineyards. So my dream is to have each of my vineyard being sandwiched with crops that are not vines, but we cultivate, and we cultivate biodynamically. And the result of that cover crop is going to nourish the family, the team, and the agriturismo, the whole hospitality that we have. So nowadays, we have 10 hectares on top of the 17. We have 10 hectares of crop rotation in within I plant sunflowers, fava
which
beans,
will contribute to the whole environment.
Chickpeas, and we...
Well, we'll talk about that later. Yeah. You do a lot with chickpea and flour and all that, which is, you know, very exciting too. So it's all farmed. It's all your land. Like you said, you don't buy, you don't sell. That's exciting. Let's move into the cellar a little and discuss how you vinify and cellar your wines.
Yeah.
You know, you talked about, you know, we're not beating up the terms organic, biodynamic, and you're just doing it by practice, you know, and like hand picking is really, you know, you don't want a machine, you don't machine the land and all that. What steps, you talked about a little, what steps do the grapes go through when they get to the cellar? Do they, foot trodden and then dumped into the concrete?
Yeah, straight away. So that this is for the whites. So the idea is to have a very quick stimulation of skin and juice at the very first beginning to allow the juice to have everything that it needs for complete isonospontaneous fermentation, but also to have the basis for long-term aging. So there's a stimulation, and then only the juice goes to ferment. So
you
there's
pull
no
the
farther.
Skins out.
Yeah, there's no farther maceration.
How long is that?
45 minutes for 300 kilos of grapes.
That's it?
That's it.
The contact and the skin stay 45 minutes.
And then
they're out of there, and then that gives you the.
Yeah. I like to start with a rich must. We normally, there's never any débourbage, so I make the juice ferment, and grandfather historically made ferment with like a very rich situation. And the first racking happens only after mallow. So everything ferments in concrete.
Tell everyone what mallow.
Malolactic fermentation.
Tell
so
them
we're,
what that is.
We're transforming. We never block or inhibit the malolactic fermentation, which is
it's something that happens naturally.
Spontaneous fermentation.
You can control it. You let it go naturally.
Yeah. Because otherwise, like you could block it through a lot of sulfur, but this is kind of not what we're doing.
Letting the wines go through malolactic fermentation adds what to the wine?
Makes the wine, I'd say, more tender.
People use the word creamy sometimes.
Creamy, yes, because you're transforming the malic acid into lactic acid, which is a less strong acid.
Softer.
So it makes the wine, a different texture. Like, it becomes creamier on a textural level and more integration, I would say.
So you use indigenous yeast, which is not adding outside yeast. It's the yeast that naturally occurs. obviously yeast is so important to the process.
Huge.
Don't you need to sort of protect the area, which I think is what you're doing, so that you'll always have these healthy yeasts?
Yes.
I mean, you want a healthy biosphere, right?
So the way it happens,
if that stops or it's not, you're screwed.
The way it happens is that life is all around us, right? And you're creating a balance and an equilibrium in within everything that you have. Yeast, they are out there in the nature, and then you bring the grapes back, and the strains of yeast, they come into your cellar and they settle in.
But they are what they are. You don't.
They
manipulate.
Are what they are. You cannot pick the ones that you like better than others.
But
you have to
take
them
analyzed? There's all kinds of different crazy
shit. Yeah, for sure.
It's not like a mono thing where it's pretty much the same.
No.
There's all kinds.
You have like.
Does that vary vintage to vintage? Weather controls it.
Vineyard to vineyard.
Makes total sense.
Yeah.
What's around it.
And we've been having fun in analyzing the DNA of those strains of yeast that are contributing and participating to our fermentation. And it's quite exciting because it actually, you have those ambient cellar yeast that, because they are in the cellar, they will contribute to all your ferments. But you have those little strains that are endemic to one vineyard in one season. And that's what make the wine reflect the season as well.
Plus the site and the plot,
too.
Oh,
yeah.
Because that strain may be different than whether it's sunlight, exposure,
and it's
irrigation.
very fascinating to see how they work throughout the fermentation, because you have the very little yeast that would start at the very first beginning, and they would only act for like a couple of hours, and then the whole family will die, and then another one will take over, and then they will die, and then the third one, and like that for like 40 different strains, 40, 50 different strains. And in a cellar where never any selected yeast has been introduced, you can clearly imagine that there is a huge population coming into the ground.
Do you think you guys obsess over yeast more than other wineries?
Oh, God. I don't know. I love it personally.
But
like,
I don't hear people, you know. I mean,
I spend
people
my evening.
Pay attention to a lot of things. That's one of them. But you seem to be very focused.
I spend my evenings during fermentation watching into a microscope.
So two things. That's very good and important to your wine, but you got to get a life too.
Yeah.
You got to go out and not stare.
Come to New York and drink all wine.
Not stare at yeast. You got to have a drink with some friends or something. Not even wine, maybe a beer. So that's interesting. You know, that's part of the whole thing that makes these wines so interesting.
Yeah.
I think another thing, which is uber surprising based on the size of the winery and how long you've been doing it, you have a cellar, which you talked about, you know, your grandfather built the space of, what is it, over 350,000 bottles of multi-vintage wines. So that's based on what you said earlier, and now let's expand on it, that your grandfather realized Montepulciano d'Abruzzo needs to age, is highly ageable. So he would make wine and age a lot of it.
But yeah.
Tell me about that.
Cellar is today packed. We have no more space. So we're building a new one.
Oh, you are?
Yeah. And that shows also, like, grandfather proved it right. You know, like, time proved him right. And at the very first beginning, nobody had done that before. Nobody
had. It wasn't economically a good idea.
No idea. God knows. But he consistently aged a good chunk of his production, consistently, year after year, year after year, not knowing how that was turning out to be.
So if you think of vintage, these arbitrary numbers, there's 4,000 bottles.
Yeah.
400 cases, whatever. He'll decide, I'm going to take 40%, 30, half of that, age it, and the other would go to the market?
Yeah, historically half. Yeah.
Historically half. But it's sort of almost a contradiction, because he believes the aging benefits the wine, but he's letting wines out in the market.
Yeah, because he needed still some money.
Well, of course. But I guess some people would drink it within a few years. And a lot of people, if they knew the wine, probably laid it down like he did too. Yeah.
And that's kind of why it's happening nowadays. We're still operating with the same system. So half of our production comes from our very, very old vineyard. There are two parcels that one was planted in 1974. The other one was planted in 1966. The wine coming from those two parcels is always the wine that will go into the aging cellar and would only be released after.
Those parcels are the most ageable because of the composition, the exposure.
The age of the vines. And on the label you read Selezione Vecchie Vigne, that's the only wine that we export. That's the only wine that we feel confident in letting travel. And then there's another part coming from our slightly younger vineyard that is released only in Italy, and it's released only 3 years after 3 years. But that finances...
I would die to drink that. Why is it just released in Italy? It's just a pain in the ass
just because
to get it out of there?
We don't want it to travel because it's, it's, you know.
Okay, so that's fair.
Grandfather would always say, would you let a 3-year-old kid take a plane on its own and go into the U.S.?
You're letting
a 40-year-old do that.
So here's what perplexes me a little. So you have this incredibly cool philosophy about aging.
Yeah.
Maybe not unique, but not common.
For sure.
Maybe not the first and only guy to do it, but I mean really committed to it. You have all this wine. What's the process in determining what wine is released, what vintage year?
Yeah, so every year.
Does it vary or is it formula, like it's 10-year-old vintage?
It varies.
And so is that by tasting or?
We do one tasting. I release my allocations the first week of January, and normally through Christmas the whole family we taste everything that it's in the cellar.
So we're drinking a 2000.
Yeah.
When was that released?
Now, 2023.
So when did you determine the 2000's good to go to the market?
Christmas 2022.
You sat around, you were doing your tastings, and you said this was how many other vintages?
We normally release 10 different vintages at a time. So all our importers...
What's the latest vintage?
2015.
Okay.
And the oldest, it's 83.
So the 2000 somewhere in the middle.
Yeah. So every importer that receives an allocation, a direct allocation from us, receive some of the current release and the other part of the allocation divided by 10 back library vintages with clearly smaller quantities, but they have access to all those library.
There was less wine made now that you've added hectares.
Yeah.
Hopefully 20 years from now, a 20-year-old wine will have more bottles than...
Hopefully.
Right?
Hopefully.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Okay.
I say that. But that's how it happens, yeah. So it's the luxury of releasing the wine exactly when it's performing at its best.
Is that by committee? How many people are tasting it?
Just the whole family, so it's 5 of us.
Very subjective, I guess.
Yeah, indeed.
It's what you think.
Yeah, wine making is subjective.
Well,
we're trying to make the wine that we like. We're trying to sell the wine that we think we like drinking at that specific
time.
So
we're sitting here in November of 2023. You know, you don't make a lot of wine, so sometimes they're difficult to get. So the current newest vintage, you said, is what?
2015, yeah.
And then, like you said, you go back to the 80s and all of that at different levels. I run into this a lot, and it's been happening, where a wine is so terrific for all the right reasons. It's made well. It's made thoughtfully. Specific things go into it, like the way you age it and all that. But here's what happens. There's not a lot of it made. That makes it hard to get. And there's this secondary market, not necessarily the one that you control, that makes it expensive. Like, you don't participate in that.
Mm-hmm.
A restaurant will buy your wines that serves it for what you sell it for. Hopefully, you could raise the prices through the years because of supply and demand and all that. But they can go in... doesn't that drive you crazy? Or it's just something in wine you have to accept? Is there anything you could do? Or
it does. Spreading out information is definitely one of the best things to like inform buyers that they should only buy through official distribution, because everything else, it transcends my control over temperature, over quality of travel, over the wines that I decide are ready to drink. If I'm releasing certain wines only in Italy and I'm bottling with very little sulfur because they're not meant to travel, and then I find them in New York, that pisses me off. Because it's...
Who's doing that? Somebody's buying it there and secondarily?
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't benefit the quality of the wine, which is why use the words, it's pissing me off. Yes. That's not the product that you want.
But once I inform every buyer that they should only buy through our official importers who receive an allocation and they have the exclusivity over Pepe in New York, then it makes it easier because you have a lot of knowledgeable people knowing exactly what they're buying.
And who they want to sell it to, who should get it. So Poliner has been your importer for forever. Well, they share similar sensibilities to, you know, what you do and all of that. I think that's fair. But if people want to try your wines, the best opportunities would be at certain restaurants that understand, believe your wines, and go out of their way to get it.
Yeah, they mainly go through
certain retailers.
Yeah, some retailer, but
there's no other way, really. There's no online. There's no mailing list. I mean, New York, we're in New York, but there's a big country. New York's easier to,
everything
you
can acquire
find these wines
in New York,
and all of that.
For sure.
That's interesting. That frustrates me because Burgundy's been like that, you know, for years.
Whoa.
All right, so we got to wrap up. I want to ask you about a couple more things. One thing that I'm so impressed with is in doing the show and talking to people and tasting wines, and if you just focus on Italy, that I think the greatest winemakers are women. I think you, Elisabetta Foridori, Acapinti,
a bunch of girls.
Stella Di Campalto, are not making good wines. They're making
great
and some of the most interesting, you know, and thoughtful wines. And I don't want to let that go unnoticed because it sounds like at your place, it's women running the place.
It's a lot of women.
I think you mentioned your brother
may jump in
a few years because he's younger or whatever. But I think that's awesome. And like I said,
it's incredible. It's so cool.
So before we wrap up, talk to me about two things. There's a very cool hospitality aspect about Pepe.
Yes.
And there's some incredible food products that you're making.
Yeah.
And I know that because a lot of wine people in New York and Psalms, whenever they get their hands on stuff, whether it's the flour, they're posting the crap out of it. Can't wait to cook this tonight and all of that.
Yeah.
You know, so start with hospitality.
Yeah.
There's something going on the property.
Yes. And it's my sister's domain. So she's in charge of this. It was the house where grandfather was born. And we turned into 7 rooms and a restaurant.
Neat.
And the restaurant is pretty much a farm-to-table, extremely well-executed raw produces that we farm and we grow on-site. So we have a biodynamic garden, and we grow our wheats, and our chef makes incredible sourdough bread. And
so you have little fields of wheat that you're making your flour?
Yeah, of Anzin wheats. Same philosophy that occurs in wine, and it goes into food production, right? And so... In the kitchen, they're extremely careful in treating those produce with the utmost respect. And my sister pairs with all our wines. And so people can come and stay. And there's this little corner in Abruzzo of, you know, how we live at Pepe. And
must be incredible.
She's an incredible host.
Wait, are the wines just Pepe wines or you bring in...
For now, they're just Pepe.
I got to get there before you change your mind.
No. For now, it's our Pepe. And the menu changes every night because what we...
Based on ingredients,
you know, what
available.
We pick every day is different. And
Does it have a specific name?
Agriturismo e Medio Pepe. Yeah? Okay. So it's like it's all on the same site. Right. And so my sister changes the pairing every night. And it's a very informal place with an incredible quality of produces, I would say.
So if I lived in that area, I'd eat there every night. I hope and assume it's busy.
It is busy. We have a lot of New Yorkers coming. It's incredible to see. We have collectors from all around the world coming to spend their summer holiday there because they want to learn more about the wines and have access to a lot of back vintages that they don't find abroad. And so it's kind of like an incredible place where they can, you know, explore and learn more about all the vintages and then see what we're doing in the cellar and walk the vines and, you know.
Incredible. It's incredible that you make that accessible to people. Tell me about the products. We talked about wheat. You make flour,
so
chickpea,
pasta,
oil.
My dream is that every vineyard should be sandwiched by fields of non-vineyard thing. And
grow these type of things.
Yes. So everything that can nourish the family, the guests at the Agriturismo, and my team with healthy, highly nutritious food. So we are on a long base crop rotation of 5 years. So one crop doesn't go back into the same field before 5 years. And I grow a lot of different
stuff. To regenerate the land and everything?
Yeah, and to have like a long process. And we go lentils, chickpeas, fava beans, those we don't eat, which is, it's very good for nitrogen absorption of the soil. Sunflowers, because they're beautiful.
And fields of them?
Fields of them.
That's cool.
And then we do Ancien wheats, and we do a durum and a tender. The durum is for pasta making. We make Senatore Cappelli, that it's pastified by an artisanal pastificio and makes very low temperature and long drying pasta that it's like incredibly high quality and bronze extruded. So we make our own pasta, and the flour that has been using at the Agriturismo for bread making and all the handmade pasta that we make and the cakes for breakfast.
Wow.
Olive oil. We have around 600 trees of olive trees. Of
older trees that have been on the property, or you planted them through the years?
They were planted in the middle of the 80s. So okay. They're not extremely old, but
no,
you know,
but
fairly. And they're all a mixture of varietals, and we press them cold, and so we make some olive oil. So basically,
do you send them out to be pressed, or do you have a, like, you
no,
make
we don't
wine
have a press
off premise? So,
yeah, we don't.
The olive oil, you send the olive oil.
Yeah, and basically, at the Agriturismo, on certain period of the season where our biodynamic garden, it's very, you know, productive, they manage to serve 85% of everything that is grown on site.
Wow.
85%. It's incredible.
That's awesome. That should be a formula for everyone.
And I think this is also replicating Abruzzo farming style of back in the 60s, because each family had a little field of wheat, a little olives, and a little wine. And now we're making everything to sustain the family. It's like, it's autarchy. And that's what I'm trying to reproduce on a scale of a farm that, you know, has a team, has importers all over the world, and has people coming in to see. And so it's, I'm just trying to multiply that, but not changing the concept really.
Right. One of the things I mentioned to you earlier that I realized we didn't discuss, and do this in 2 minutes or less.
Mm-hmm.
Everything we're talking about takes place in Abruzzo.
Yes.
People are like, people who know. They go, where the hell is Abruzzo? So Abruzzo is in central Italy. Take it from there.
Yes.
And tell me the location, the influences, Adriatic mountains.
Yeah.
Just tell me quickly.
Well, two
which
minutes.
Which affects what you do every day, whether it's the grains or the grapes or whatever.
Central Italy towards the Adriatic coast. So east side. If you think of Rome and you draw a line towards the Adriatic coast, that's exactly where we are.
Okay.
We are on the northern corner that borders the Adriatic Sea. On the east and to the north, it's Le Marche region. So we are in the northest part of Abruzzo. Abruzzo is a region that for the 75%, it's mountainous, but also has 300 kilometers of coast. So basically, where we are 10 kilometers from the Adriatic Sea, and we are 80 kilometers from the peak of the Gran Sasso mountain, which is the highest mountain of the Apennine range. So So in within 90 kilometers, we go from 3,000 meters to sea level. So you can imagine it's very steep, and there are a lot of current of winds going back and forth accordingly to the temperatures and the pressures. But it's a very windy area, and where we are located, it's a lot of rolling hills formation. It's alluvial, as the mountains were formed of the Apennines, you know, the sea
alluvial
retracted.
Soils?
Alluvial soil.
Okay.
The sea retracted and the mountains being washed out, a lot of alluvial creating those rolling hills that basically it's the only cultivable space and within the mountains that cover most part of Abruzzo and the sea. Is that 2 minutes?
Yeah, less, but it sounds like a pretty special place. I mean, not the only place that's surrounded by coastal influence and mountains, but one of the few, you know, and the soils there are very interesting. All right. I told you that I won't let you leave here without you doing my wine list. I ask every one of my guests the same 5 questions, and you need to answer them, and I'm going to give you some advice. Don't take a long time. Don't dwell on your answers.
Mm-hmm.
These are spontaneous answers. If you can't think of something, you can't think of something.
So okay.
Here's the first question. First question is, what are you drinking now? What's in your fridge? What are you experimenting with? Are you shifting because the seasons are changing? You know, what now, not always?
I have to mention a specific wine.
You can. You could talk, you know, you're like a champagne, whatever.
Brunello.
So do you always drink Brunello or are you drinking a little more now? Why?
I'm drinking it now because it's fall.
Okay, so that's a seasonal change, heavier wine.
And one of my favorite. And nowadays, I'm specifically drinking the Rosso from Paradiso di Manfredi. Like that's the easiest pick on my
Rosso
fridge.
The Rosso from which vineyard?
Paradiso di Manfredi.
Okay. The Rosso, not the Mont.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because we can talk more about Rosso and Brunello, but.
No, I'm on that. That's another show. Give me something else you're drinking. Different than Brunello.
Right now, I'm also drinking Cabernet Franc from Loire because I'm thinking that that is a very interesting vision of understanding freshness coming from variety and not from acidity. I leave you with that.
The Loire does it right. All right, second question, maybe the goofiest one in the bunch. What is your favorite wine and food pairing? Not what you think is a good wine, but what do you like? Is it your own wines? Is it something else? Champagne and oysters? I mean, and obviously you don't eat it all the time, but when you do, it's like, oh, this is roast chicken and Burgundy. It goes well every day. What's your favorite wine?
I would say very good Sauvignon from Jura and Comté would bring me to heaven all the time.
Wow. So I don't think anyone's ever answered that, but I think that's really good.
Mm-hmm.
The grape goes great with the cheese.
Yeah.
The cheese has some character.
Yeah,
not
aged,
that
Comté,
sharp, but it's
and salty and Sauvignon.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
You did good on that one.
Good.
All right, third question. And this question could be around home, in your travels, but what I want to ask you is your favorite wine restaurant and or bar. And let me preface a few things. What's a place you go into that has a great wine list? Maybe it's just a wine bar. Maybe it's a restaurant that has a great wine list. The vibe in the place is great. The people are knowledgeable. It's cool. What's a place like that? Now, I don't want you to think that if you mention something, you left friends out or these are your top. What are some places that you feel good about going into? Is there anything locally to start?
Very fast
right,
in my
answer
mind.
Answer that.
The first one is a place in Piemonte.
What's
it
called?
And it's a restaurant where just a couple runs it. There are two people running that restaurant.
Those are the places I'm looking
and
for.
And they have the best Financiera, which is this dish made out of offals that is very typical in Piemonte. To me, that it
offal or organ meats.
Yeah,
you like that stuff.
Wait, let me finish with the wine pairing.
Don't yell at me.
Because that is And Marco, the chef, to me, makes the most incredible version of it. And when I go there, I would pull a bottle of Acquamasso, Rocca dell'Annunziata, and I'll be very happy.
That's it, huh? Mm-hmm. Certainly an interesting answer. What, anything else? You know, anything stick out in New York, or if you're in Rome or Europe, are there other
places? Another place that it's very dear to my heart is a place right in front the house where I was living in Burgundy, Beaune, and it's a place called La Dilettante.
Sure.
It's one of the greatest wine bars in the world.
So Jean-Baptiste Le Callion was on last week. I asked everyone the same question.
Did he answer the same bar? Amazing.
And also, it wasn't him. It was Byron Bates. Byron runs the Wild World Festival, which is another natural. Mm-hmm. Jean-Baptiste didn't. But it did come up within the last few weeks. Yeah. All right. Great answers. I didn't mention this, but I post your answers on social media because people love to hear, you know, what.
Where do the winemakers go?
Well, yeah, you know. All right. Fourth question. Favorite all-time wine? When I initially asked the question, I wanted to know the most expensive and rare wine that Chiara ever drank. I don't care about that. I want to know your favorite all-time wine, that wine that influenced the way you think about wine, that was a gateway, that transcended you, something that was important. You know, is there a wine or two that you drank that is just so important to how you think about wine now?
Yeah.
What?
There are two.
What?
There are two.
Okay. Two was good.
As a young girl, I had 07 Brezé from Rougeard.
Clos Rougeard?
Clos Rougeard.
Rosé?
Brezé.
Oh, Brezé.
And that change a lot of things.
What was it
and
about?
The other
it?
One,
you had never tasted anything like that?
He rang a lot of bells in within.
Okay, that's a great answer. Mm. What do you know about 07? Did you taste the 07? Because that's what was
it was
around?
Pre-Mallow.
Okay.
It was in 2010, Clojure changed cellar. And the previous cellar was much colder. Mallow wasn't running because
so
the cellar was...
So this is sort of the old school stuff. Yeah. Okay. What's the second one?
Soldera. Gianfranco Soldera.
What year? Anything? Or just in general?
I had a bunch because I did a whole study around them. And
would you say that's one of the best Brunellos made?
Soldera. I think it's one of the very best wine Italy has ever produced.
Okay. Not easy to get either. Those are great answers. And like I said, I'm going to post them. Final question. And this may be a little harder for you than other people. The question is, I want you to recommend to me the best wines, a red and a white, around $15, $20, $23 U.S. retail. And like Will, my son, was here earlier. He can't show up at a party or a dinner with a crappy supermarket wine for $11. But he can't afford $45, $50 either. So what wines? You can go by category. You can go by maker, whatever. What red and what wine are the best quality to value in your mind? Did I stump you?
It's a complicated question.
Like Muscadet in France is very reasonable. And if you get the right stuff, it's, you know, stuff
I think you also find a lot of, value in Chianti.
That's a common answer because it's a real answer. So Chianti for red is a great answer. Some are more than that, but you can find stuff around that range. So that checks the box for red, which is usually harder for most people. Where are you going to go with white? You drink Sicilian wines?
Fiano in Campania.
Okay. So Campania and Fiano.
Yeah.
Good answer. All right. Pretty good.
Awesome. God, that was
good.
Stressful.
I didn't mean to stress you out. All right.
No, so they weren't.
We're almost at the end, and I like the fact that we saved this for the end. We do a feature at the end of the show called the Weekly Wine Sip, where mm-hmm. we taste, evaluate, and talk about a wine. And in my mind, it's crazy not to have a winemaker bring their wine and have them talk about it. So that concept makes sense. But when you have Chiaro with Pepe Abruzzo di Montepulciano, it's even better. So whether you get mad at me or not, I'm pouring a little more because I drank some.
In Magnum. That is also...
So I will set it up and you will talk about it. So Chiaro was kind enough, we use this old Italian term, to schlep around a Magnum bottle of the 2000 Montepulciano di Abruzzo from Emilio Pepe. All right, let's talk about this wine a little, and then we're going to taste it. So this is one of the current releases that you evaluated should be released.
Yeah, I think it's in a very sweet drinking spot right now. I think early 2000s are now showing particularly well. They are in that evolution stage in which they've gained complexity and they still have a lot of energy and they're calling for food. And I think they're in a very sweet spot because, like, they get more exciting in the nose and still they have, you know, tannins that they got, you know, more in balance in within the structure. And they still have a lot of liveliness and freshness to it.
So I'm looking at this wine and I'm drinking it, and we're going to talk about color, nose palette and all that. But all of that, it's still a very energetic, young wine.
Yeah.
It's terrific in that sense. There's no real sense of, you know, any kind of aging. I'm sure now from when it came out a few years later, there's some,
sure.
But the fruit is there.
Yeah.
The tannins are there. What was the 2000 vintage like?
It was a very balanced season with a very warm summer.
Okay.
So if we think like 01, for example, has been a much more iconic vintage for us because it really had the rain at the right time and the sun at the right time. And this was exactly the same, just with a warmer summer. And only yesterday I was saying, oh, is it 2000 a warm summer? A warm vintage. I was like, yeah, we can call it a warm vintage, but our conception of warm season has been totally changed.
Now versus
what it was. Because yeah. Now I've had 2021 being warm, and by warm I say 70 millimeters of water. Wow. Since bud break till harvest time. That is warm. That probably, we call it warm, but wasn't the same.
I know.
You know, like, it's, we even changed, like, our idea of what is warm, you know.
It's so, a whole different thing.
Yeah.
All right. So let's do some evaluation and talk about it. Let's give it a sniff and we'll throw it over the tongue and you'll tell me stuff. So the color for a 20-year-old wine has virtually no bricking. This is basically, and you have to tell me this, I'm almost asking, this is basically similar to the color on release.
I would say
lighten up a little.
Yeah.
But it's holding color nicely.
Holding color. Normally there are wines that age very, very slowly.
Okay.
Because they've never received any sort of oxidation in the earlier stage. They've never seen any ochre or any micro oxygenation. So they tend to retain energy for a very long time.
For sure. All right. Let's stick your nose in there and tell me what descriptors you get on the nose.
That is so tricky to say to a winemaker that.
Well, don't make me come over there and twist your arm. So a couple things.
Yeah.
That's fair to say that.
Yeah.
But I still need you to help me. There's two things. What are the typical traditional nose aspects of Montepulciano di Abruzzo?
Yeah.
Red fruit,
would I say,
dark fruit.
Yeah, you normally have a lot of red fruit. Like right. I see like a lot of cherry here.
It's so funny when we poured it, yeah. The cherry thing
cherry
grew
and
out.
Chocolate, I would
yeah,
say.
Not strawberry
on,
or...
Yeah,
yeah,
cherry and chocolate right now.
Definitely
it's
chocolate.
What you have, yeah.
That's this too.
Yeah,
but you'll get too. That in... The wines,
yeah,
but it can vary.
A brighter version
right.
of them. And,
right.
and
what else is in there?
They're always, like, unless they are rainy vintages like 2002, 2013, and 14.
What does the rain do?
They bring them on a floral profile, but normally they're on a fruit profile. So
rain will bring more floral out?
Yeah.
So you'll
yeah.
know a rainy vintage.
Yeah.
All right, let's go mouthfeel. I think these wines are beautiful in the mouth, but they're not these glycerin-y, unctuous wines. Okay. They're medium.
Yeah. Yeah, right now you have like a solid tannin integration. Like,
unbelievable.
Tannins are there, present, but they create this velvety sensation all around your mouth and with a kick of acidity that is still there and brings freshness and brings length.
All right, so that's the mouthfeel. Let's talk about the palate. I need you to do palate descriptors. Do the palate descriptors replicate a lot of the nose descriptors, or are there, is there cherry on the palate? What
Sam,
else?
Sam, you're better doing this than me doing this, really.
I suck at this.
Same. Go ahead.
I get the cherry on the palate. I get the red fruit. I'm trying to think of what else. That subtle stuff that I'm not good at. What else?
Well, for me, like historically, I've always learned to taste wine texturally, and now I taste them texturally, and you have a lot of that leather thing
yes.
coming up, you know?
That's what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
What you know is there, but you can't describe it.
Yeah.
For sure, even in the nose a little. All right, so this wine, what's a good pairing with this wine?
Woo, lamb. You need
lamb?
To have lamb with it.
Okay.
This calls for lamb all over
okay.
it. Okay. Stewed lamb,
lamb
with peppers,
leg,
yeah.
all
yeah.
that stuff.
Yeah.
Because it stands up to a little of the lamb gaminess, meaty,
yeah.
a little fat.
Yeah.
All of that it
yeah.
pairs well with.
Yeah.
So if I say to you, who's your favorite kid, that's an unfair question.
Oh.
But when you look at the 2000 vintage, where
yeah.
do you...
Navigate?
Where do you... Is that one of the better ones? Was that a tougher one? Or?
Oh, no. This was like one of the solid, more iconic
okay.
vintages that
this
we've
had.
This
is a really
so,
solid...
Very
Pepe. Right.
Very Pepe.
Which is really, which is really
do.
All you want.
Yeah.
All right. So like I said, I will post... Kiara's wine list answers, and I will post info on the wine that we tasted. Let me do a quick wrap up, and I want to get some information from you about a lot of things we talked to. So if you have a question, suggestion, wine happening or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or Google Podcasts, or wherever you go to get your pods. Of course, if you like the podcast, leave a positive review. You can follow us on Instagram, where we post a lot of the stuff I've been telling you, at SBenRuby, and on X at BenRuby, two different handles. But you can always reach us with the hashtag TheGrapeNation to find us on both. We are also on Facebook at The Grape Nation. As I mentioned, we will post Kiara's wine list, those five questions and her great answers, and the weekly wine sip. I'll give you more information on the wine that we tasted on our social media sites. All right. So, Kiara, where can we find more information about you? If people personally want to follow you on Instagram, like what's she up to?
So,
and where can we find more information on Emidio Pepe, which includes the wines, the agrotourism, the product.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of different things that where
yeah.
do we
Well easier to, you know, keep all the updates and the write ups and the all the news that we have and our thoughts on farming and agriculture is on Instagram. I'm Emidio Pepe and
okay.
that's me running
is that
the
an account. That you control?
Yeah, it's me personally.
Because I know it's your name, yeah.
It's me personally.
So you think it's the winery, but
so
it's
yeah,
you. But it's a little of everything.
And yeah, and website, www.emidiopepe.com. It's where all the bookings of the Agriturismo happens and all the, you know, but like the deeper stuff and
the
vineyard maps.
The food products, are they available in the U.S. or you have to order them?
Every now and then. We make such a small quantity
okay.
for now that it's complicated, but hopefully in the future when I expand my project of farming.
Right, which
will be
a lot of exciting things in the future.
Yeah.
And we talked about the wines. The wines are at, you know, certain restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
The importer feeds them to certain retailers and all of that. It's not a secret that the production is not high. They're very sought after, so they're not easy to get. I didn't bring Kiara on to tease you. to get interested in the wines and not be able to get them. One way or another, you will be able to get them. But I think it's important to know the commitment and the history and what's going on over there and how Chiara's carrying the torch. So I want to thank you for coming on. I've been looking forward to this. I will see you tomorrow at Caractere. Good Amazing. Luck with that. I hope one day to be trotting through your vineyards.
That would be lovely.
I mean, I would go out of my way. If I was in Kazakhstan, I would take a flight to Abruzzo, you know?
That would be lovely, Sam.
So thank you to Chiara Pepe for taking a generous amount of time to talk about everything. Thank you, as always, to our engineer, Armin, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.